acted in both his blood and the boy's, didn't seem to hear him.
He was just a fucking kid.
Chapter 3. In the Khmeri embassy house, a knock came at Ramad Amansir's door.
Come, he called.
As the heavy carved door groaned inward, Ramad stopped writing. He looked up to find not a servant, as he had expected, but Amaryllis. It was winter moving into spring in the desert. The city had been cool, even cold at times, but you wouldn't know it from looking at her. She was wearing the sort of clothes a West End harlot might wear, a slit skirt that revealed her shapely legs well past her knees whenever she moved, and a sleeveless shirt she tied around her waist to reveal her belly and accentuate the curves of her breasts. Both garments were dyed a vibrant mix of orange and ruby red, a match for the dozen ribbons she had braided into her hair. Together the clothes and the ribbons were a perfect contrast to her dark hair, which cascaded down past her shoulders in curly locks, accentuating a look that was already sultry.
"Can we talk?" she asked.
"Is it important?"
"It's about Tehran."
Ramad immediately put his quill back in its inkwell.
"You found him?"
She took one of the two chairs by the open patio doors behind him. The chair was so large, and Amaryllis so relaxed as she pulled one foot onto the seat, that she looked like a rag doll tossed there and forgotten.
"I found him."
Ramad joined her in the sunlight, which warmed him to the point of discomfort.
"Where?"
"In the shallows. A drug den owned by a woman known as the Widow."
The look that had settled over Amaryllis was one of regret or despair. Perhaps it was both.
"He's deep into the reek. He won't last a fortnight if he stays there."
"Did you speak to him?"
"I tried, but he just lay there, staring at the shisha."
Amaryllis paused, lips curling in disgust as she gazed through him.
"It was a sty, Ramad. People everywhere, naked, filthy. It smelled like a charnel for the damned."
"Is he still there?"
Amaryllis shrugged.
"Probably. He likely paid them ahead so that they'd keep him there, filled with the drug until the coin ran out."
Ramad pinched the bridge of his nose, remembering the Tehran of old. He'd always been dour but strong as steel, the sort of man Ramad depended on in the desert, so far from home. Whatever burden Ramad had given him, he'd shouldered it and borne it silently. Until they had gone to King Kiral's palace, Eventide, on the Night of Endless Swords. That was the night he and Meriem, disguised as Amaryllis, had gone with Tehran, his cousin Lucan, and 11 others to destroy King Kiral's cache of elixirs hidden beneath Eventide. Lucan had fallen, ravaged by a demon made from the stuff of nightmares, skinless body, eyeless head, massive, sweeping horns. Meriem, desperate, had fed on Lucan's heart and used the power gained to save them all. Tehran was a hard man, but Lucan had been like a brother to him. Even the hardest men can become brittle in ways that cannot be seen. His grief weighed heavily, and he finally broke, turning to Black Lotus and embracing it like a newfound lover. Though he tried to hide his growing dependence on it, it quickly became an open secret. Everyone in the embassy house knew, and Ramad had looked the other way, hoping it would help Tehran forget that he'd find the will to stop on his own. But after watching him stumble down a set of stairs and hardly notice the pain, Ramad had confronted him. Tehran grew angry. angrier than Ramad had seen him in years. He denied it all, and for a time things had improved, but then Tiron began staying in the city overnight. He'd claimed it was for a girl, a seamstress, who created beautiful embroidery, even brought a few pieces to show Ramad. A night here or there turned into days away, and it soon became clear Tiron had found a shisha den somewhere in the city. Ramad demanded that it stop. Their argument had shaken the walls, and Tiron had stormed out. He hadn't been seen since. That had been 2 weeks ago. Ramad had sent Amaryllis and others to find him, even making inquiries himself when he found the time, but they'd had no word of him until today. Ramad glanced at his desk, at the half-finished letter sitting atop the leather blotter. He was working to secure Meriem's power in Chimer against those who wished for any other to sit the throne. He'd been working to secure her power here in Sharakai as well. Neither was certain. The work was important. He had a dozen more letters to write before a caravan left for Chimer in the morning. But Tiron was important too.
"Let's go and get him."
Amaryllis nodded, and the harried look on her face eased. They were heading for the door when another knock came. The door opened before Ramad had a chance to reply, and in strode Basilio, the heavy-set lord who was Chimer's primary ambassador in Sharakai. Basilio's round face was blotchy, as if he had sprinted up the stairs.
"He looks scared," Ramad thought.
Basilio took out a kerchief and patted his forehead dry.
"You must come with me."
"It will have to wait for my return."
"Your queen requests your presence."
"Tell the queen it is important. She'll understand."
"She most certainly will not."
Ramad shoved past him.
"Lord Amansir,"
Basilio groused.
"A messenger has arrived from Eventide. Our queen's presence has been requested, and she is of mind to attend, and..."
Ramad turned.
"What?"
Basilio straightened himself up.
"For some reason,"
he pulled his vest down to cover more of his belly,
"she requested that you attend her rather than me."
Worms churned inside Ramad's gut. They always did when the precariousness of Meriem's position here in Sharakai struck him. She wanted to accept an invitation from Kiral, the King of Kings. Gods! If only she'd left the day after the Night of Endless Swords, as Ramad had bade her. The kings might have lost four of their number, Azad, Kulishan, Yusam, and Mesut, but they were still more dangerous than a pit of scorpions. Better for Meriem to deal with them from the safety of Almadan. However often she might insist that remaining in the Amber City would lead to better terms, dealing with the kings face to face was an act of tempting fate, pure and simple. Amaryllis looked as nervous as Ramad felt. Basilio, his gaze swinging between the two of them, noticed.
"Will you not tell me what happened that night?"
It was a rare bit of vulnerability from Basilio, who was always trying to push Ramad, to exert his authority and ensure that he was the queen's most trusted servant. Were they back in Chimer, Ramad might have relented and told how he and Meriem had joined forces with the Moonless Host, how they'd stolen into Eventide and destroyed the cache of glowing blue elixirs that gave the kings their long life. But they weren't in Chimer, and the danger of gossip was simply too great.
"Take Chichio and Vrago with you,"
Ramad said to Amaryllis.
"Get Tiron, take him to the safe house near the pits. I'll come when I'm able."
Amaryllis nodded and left. Basilio, meanwhile, puffed himself up like a pompous peacock.
"Keep your secrets, then. But I deserve to know why King Kiral,
wishes to speak with Queen Meriam. I don't know, Basilio,
Ramad sniffed, somewhat enjoying the affronted look on Basilio's blotchy face.
But rest assured, the queen will tell you at the appropriate time.
He turned toward Meriam's apartments, but Basilio grabbed his elbow. Rather than do something rash, Ramad slowed his pace, and when it became clear Basilio wouldn't let him go, he stopped and turned. When Basilio spoke, it was nearly a whisper.
You know how tenuous things have become in Almadan. I'm doing all I can to keep the hounds at bay. But if we are in danger because the two of you... Our kingdom stands on the doorstep of the desert, Basilio. There is always danger. You know very well what I mean.
Ramad stepped forward until the two of them were chest to chest.
And you know that to tell you more could endanger you, me, our queen, and the entire kingdom. So keep your bloody questions to yourself and be satisfied with what the queen gives you.
If Basilio's face had been blotchy before, it was a field of red now. To his credit, though, he didn't back away.
He's desperate, Ramad thought. I really do need to focus on what's happening back home, and so does Miriam. Soon.
He promised himself, and left Basilio fuming in the hall. He found Meriam in the coachyard behind the embassy house. He climbed inside the waiting coach and sat across from her as it lurched into motion. With the clop of horses' hooves mixing with the spray of gravel, Ramad leaned back into the padded bench. Meriam was propped in the corner of the bench opposite him, wearing a queen's raiment, a stunning copper dress that flared around her hips, hiding to some degree the fragility of her frame beneath.
You're shaking again, Ramad said.
Meriam licked her lips, pulling herself taller as the look of embarrassment flashed across her face.
I'll master it, ere we sit before the King of Kings.
Ramad raised his right hand where he wore a ring with a sharp needle that could be used to draw blood.
Have you need?
She shook her head, denying his offer even as her shivering became more pronounced.
It cannot be risked, even after all this time. I'm still not sure how much Kiral can sense of the red ways.
Some brandy, then.
He'd made sure her carriage was always stocked with several bottles of spirits.
I'd need to be drunk for it to have any effect.
Perhaps drunk would be better.
And perhaps a brawling mule would be better than the pestering jackdaw I find sitting before me.
She closed her eyes and tilted her head back until it rested on the bench.
I said, I will control it.
Her sharpness had everything to do with how tenuous her position was, but it made the sting no less easy to stomach, not after unrelenting weeks of it. The coach wound its way higher along the mountainside. They passed palace after palace, and Ramad wondered at it. Turiat had both the look and the feel of power, as if the mountain were made from it. These palaces had stood for well over 500 years. Together they represented a concentration of power neither the desert nor the four kingdoms surrounding it had ever seen. The kings were no fools. They used that power to their advantage, negotiating favorable trade agreements, controlling the flow of culture, food, and literature through those accords, allowing only what they'd expressly approved to move from place to place. Four kings were dead. Azad, Kulishan, Yusam, and Misut. To anyone standing in the streets of Sharakai, the House of Kings would appear as strong as it ever had, but the Ramad knew better. It was a house ready to crumble, now that they had been robbed of their immortality. How long would the kings last? Would they age like normal men? Or would they wither away until they looked like the Asyrim, their centuries of cheating the Lord of all things, catching up to them in a matter of weeks or months? Up and up they went. From this vantage, the city looked like a grand carpet, an impossibly complicated weave that brought together people from thousands of leagues distant. At last, the wagon rumbled over the drawbridge to Eventide, and the city was lost. They pulled around the large circle before the palace doors, where servants in bright finery rushed to welcome them. He and Miriam were led into the palace and up several flights of stairs, an arduous task given how slowly Miriam climbed. She refused all offers of help, though, her face grim. To Ramad's growing awe, the quivering of her body, which had become so bad he'd nearly asked her to return to the embassy house and reschedule this for another day, had all but vanished.
"Your will cannot overcome your failing body forever," Ramad thought.
He could already hear her biting reply.
"It can, Ramad Amansir, for there is work yet to do."
They reached a grand audience hall, a space made up of blue-veined, marble pillars, of niches filled with stark, stiff-backed statues, of arched domes intricately sculpted. At the far end of the hall, across a sea of patterned, mosaic flooring, sat an empty throne on a dais. An ancient woman with a sour face stood next to it. The woman was crooked with age. She moved with obvious difficulty as she took three steps down to stand below the throne, but still above Ramad and Miriam. This was Esmira, Kiral's daughter, and his Vizira, a former blade maiden. She had risen to warden, then first warden, then served as a matron for nearly 2 decades before being summoned to stand by Kiral's side as his most trusted servant.
"The king will see you shortly," she said as Miriam and Ramad came to a halt before her and bowed their heads.
She shuffled off toward the door in the corner of the room. As it clicked shut behind her, the sound echoed into the cavernous space, somehow making the space seem larger than it had moments ago. A long bout of waiting followed, and Miriam's quivering returned. She was letting down her guard while they were unobserved, but it became so bad, Ramad took a step toward the line of chairs resting against the nearby wall, prepared to move one so that Miriam could rest.
"No,"
Miriam said softly.
"This is a test, and there will be more to come. Stay where you are and be wary."
As Mira returned almost a half turn later, Miriam's shaking vanished as the imposing form of King Kiral, a man who stood nearly a head taller than Ramad, entered the room behind his vizira. Standing before his throne, he looked like one of the first men, regal, imposing, even dangerous, with flinty eyes, tightly shorn hair, and a pock-marked face. When Esmira bowed and left, Kiral gave Miriam a gesture that could barely be called a nod.
"Queen Miriam, Shan Alduan, you are well met."
He stared at Ramad as if he were little more than a nuisance.
"As are you, Lord Amansir."
"My lord king," Miriam replied.
Kiral's crown glinted as he sat on his throne, and he spoke in a voice that filled the hall.
"It has been some time since we've spoken. It's past time we rectify that, don't you agree?"
"Of that then can be no doubt,"
Miriam smiled, giving him a pleasant nod.
"But forgive me, my lord king, I don't know that we've ever spoken."
Her voice was loud, strong. No trace of her tremulous tone remained.
I meant our two kingdoms,
Kiral replied easily.
Ah, of course. But then I wonder, why haven't more of the kings been summoned? We've always dealt with Isan. I'm sure he'd prove invaluable now. There will be time to involve Isan, after you and I have come to an understanding.
The smile that stole over Meriem's skeletal face was now tinged with a hint of mischief.
Well, now we're getting somewhere. On what matter does the King of Kings wish to come to an understanding with the Queen of Chimer?
Why don't we begin with your father? How did he die?
If Meriem was surprised by this, she didn't show it.
You are blunt?
I've little enough time for many things in my life, let alone niceties. I've read the letter you sent us. I know you told Isan your father wished to sail the seas of the great Shangazi, that you were waylaid by pirates, that your ship was taken, and the two of you left for dead.
Kiral sat taller in his chair, as if he had just been insulted.
I would like the true story.
It was a moment before Meriem spoke. It looked as if she was considering how much to share and how to say it, but Ramad could tell she was suffering from her condition. Lack of sustenance. Lack of aught but wine and blood. And yet, for all his inside knowledge, he could hardly tell and was sure Kiral wouldn't see what lay behind Meriem's odd pause. But as he waited for Meriem to speak, he saw how irritated Kiral was becoming.
I will tell you, King of Kings, Meriem finally said. And then I will make a request. Something you will grant me, without hesitation, I suspect.
Kiral looked bored.
Go on.
You saw the state of my father's body.
When Kiral nodded with a tiny movement, as if assent were some precious commodity, Meriem went on.
It was done by the Erek, known as Guldraven. My father was an offering, a way to appease the beast and make it renounce its hunt for the man who had convinced it generations ago to bargain away its power. Do you know who that was?
To Ramad's surprise, there was a hunger in Keral's deep voice as he gave Meriem the name she wanted to hear.
Ham Zakir.
Ham Zakir, she echoed in satisfaction. The man the Moonless Host hoped to use for their own benefit. The man we stole from them after they raised him from his grave.
You admit it, then?
To you, yes.
The implication was clear, that she didn't wish for the story to go beyond these walls.
Name your purpose, then. Why did you seize him?
He was about to become a tool of Masid Ishagaba and his father. Men you and I both despise. It was something we couldn't allow.
You could have come to us.
She bowed her head, showing just the right amount of contrition.
In hindsight, I would certainly have done so, but Ham Zakir had much to answer for in Chimer. Now he has even more.
Kiral seemed pleased enough with that answer.
Go on.
She did. She told Kiral how they had wrested Ham Zakir from the Moonless Host, how they'd returned to Chimer, how Ham Zakir had bested her and inveigled his way into her mind. The journey to Almadan and the desert beyond was filled with regret, but none stronger than having lost Danail, his most trusted man, taken by his own knife in Black Swan Tower after Hamzakir had found him less than useful. Then Meriem came to the part of the tale Kiral seemed most eager to hear. Hamzakir leaving them in the desert for Guldrathan to find. Hamzakir had meant all three of them, King Alduin, Meriem, and Ramad, as offerings. But it was somewhat sated after devouring Alduin's heart, and then managed to strike a new bargain for their freedom. Chaedir's blood, if they failed to deliver Hamzakir. Ramad felt his cheeks redden at the memory.
And I sealed the bargain with my own blood.
How foolish it seemed now. The memory of Guldrathan's hot tongue lapping blood from his fingers made him wonder if the hunger inside him was from simple physical need or from the spell Guldrathan had worked on him in those moments. He shook the thoughts away as Meriem concluded her tale.
Desert voyagers have not been kind to you and yours.
Kiral gave a knowing smile, which Ramad wished he could strike from his face. Meriem stared back, a fire in her eyes.
Nor have the scarabs been kind to Sharakai.
The moonless host are dying like lambs in the desert.
Because you've had help, Meriem said.
Their days are always numbered.
Meriem made a show of looking around the room.
Let us be blunt, my king. Sharakai suffered greatly on the Night of Endless Swords, and we both know Hamzakir's betrayal is what has weakened the host. With his power, influence and charm, by showing how little Masid accomplished over the years, he has won many of them to his side. You have been hounding the remains of the old order since the battle in the harbor, taking what Hamzakir is willingly giving. But things are about to change again, are they not?
That depends on a great many things, such as what happens on your eastern border with Malasan and your northern with Mireya.
Meriem's voice had grown stronger. She was a power to be reckoned with, every bit Kiral's equal.
Such as what Hamzakir has in store for you all when the kings grow tired of picking at the bones of the old order.
Kiral had been indifferent, as if this were merely one more burden in his day. But now he leaned forward with the look of a falcon that had just spotted a viper slithering toward its nest across the sand.
You said you had a request. I do, my king.
Do Chimir the honor of taking this burden from your shoulders. Allow Ramad and me to hunt Hamzakir, unfettered, in the city and the desert beyond, wherever his trail might lead us.
Kiral's eyes narrowed, as if this were the last thing he had expected.
And in return?
You will give me Malasan.
A pause.
What did you say?
Malasan gathers for war,
Meriem replied easily.
And if they strike, Sharakai would drive them back across the mountains.
But why stop there? Why not sweep well beyond the mountains? Only the threat from the other kingdoms holds you back.
Meriem clasped her hands tightly.
But were Sharakai and Chimir to combine efforts?
Her voice dropped to a whisper, and it was all the more chilling for it.
Not an army in the world could stand against us. That is what I propose, O King of Kings. Let us bait those who stand on your doorstep, waiting for you to stumble. Let us draw Mireya and Malasan out. Let us run roughshod over them when they do. And then there will be more than enough to divide between our nations. I humbly request all lands of Malasan we might take, while Sharakai takes Mireya.
Keral spent nearly as much time pondering this as Meriem had done, and then in a burst of movement he stood, staring down at Meriem and Ramad with the look of a mad god. Ramad was certain Meriem had made a terrible mistake, but when Keral spoke, he said,
"Begin your hunt."
He turned and strode toward the door in the corner.
"When you fed Hamzakir's body to the Arek, you shall have your union."
The door boomed shut behind him, echoing into the room. No sooner had the sound faded than Meriem collapsed to the floor. Ramad rushed forward, cringing as her cheek slapped against the marble.
"Meriem,"
he whispered, shaking her. She didn't respond. Her eyes were heavy, her breath coming sharply as if she were in the throes of sickness.
"Gods, Meriem!"
Ramad took the ring from his finger and used it to pierce his wrist. He held it before Meriem's mouth, worried that Keral would return at any moment. There was nothing for it, though. After a speech like that, there could be no showing weakness like this, and they certainly couldn't flaunt her ability to use blood magic before the king or anyone else in Eventide. The blood trickled along Meriem's lips, dripped down to the floor, creating bright red patterns on the polished white and marble tiles. He pressed the wound to her mouth.
"Drink, damn you!"
Finally she did. A swipe of her tongue at first, then a suck from the wound. And then she was holding Ramad's wrist, pressing her warm lips tight against his bleeding flesh. More and more she took, but he refused to let it go too far and ripped his arm away despite the strength that had already returned to her. Meriem's nostrils flared. Her eyes took in the throne room, as if she hadn't truly seen it until now.
"Clean it,"
she said as she made it to her feet. Ramad used his dark sleeves to wipe up the blood, even the little that had slipped between the tiles. Meriem was licking her lips. Ramad wiped blood away from her chin and cheek until they were both satisfied that they'd left no evidence. Then a lord of Chimer, bloodied by his own choice, and his queen, giddy with the power he had granted her, left Eventide. Chapter 4. High in King Sukru's palace, Davud stood before a tall shelf in the room that had been his since he escaped from the horrors of Ishmantep. Bandages, ointments, salves and other medicinals were stacked along the shelves, all of the highest quality. Many an apothecary in Sharakai would be proud of such an assortment. It would likely last months and provide care for dozens of patients. Here, it was intended for only one. Davud took down a roll of bandages and a half-empty jar of thick salve, and walked toward the bed at the center of the room, where a woman lay covered from the waist down in a light blanket. The late morning sun was slanting in through the open windows to his right. A gentle wind tugged at the long curtains, throwing shadows across the brilliant marble floor, the ivory blankets, and the still woman who was wrapped in layers of tightly rolled bandages. Setting the bandages and salve down, he looked to the man sitting near the door, who watched Davud placidly, as he had every day of the 7 weeks since Davud's arrival. He was Davud's primary watchdog, a soldier, Davud supposed, a stocky man 20 years Davud's senior. He had a day's growth of stubble and piercing blue eyes. Most of the guards who patrolled the palace were silver spears, sometimes blade maidens. This man was different. He was a foreigner, with lighter skin and a sharp nose. Malasani, perhaps. He wore fitted leather armor most of the time, and a hooded cloak when they went outdoors. He was special, though in what way and why he had been chosen to watch Davood was unclear.
"Are you ready to tell me your name yet?"
Davood asked. The man sniffed. The chair beneath him creaked loudly as he uncrossed his legs and put both feet on the floor.
"Never you fucking mind. That's my name."
The same answer, more or less, he'd given Davood every day.
"I heard one of the other spears call you Xanthrithus yesterday."
The man glowered.
"So why'd you bloody ask?"
"Xanthrithus?"
The man rolled his eyes, his bushy eyebrows pinching menacingly.
"Nala May's teats. Call me Xander if you're going to call me anything."
"Xander, you've seen me do this 100 times. There is no danger. Couldn't you give her some privacy?"
He motioned to the woman lying on the bed before him.
"Just until I'm done."
Xander stared around wide-eyed, as if he was shocked at his own boorishness, then somehow sketched an elaborate bow while remaining seated.
"Why, most certainly, my good lord. And when you're done, would you like me to fix you some tea and rub your feet?"
"It's for her benefit, not mine."
"Oh?"
He made a show of looking over Davood's shoulder.
"Well, near as I can tell, she doesn't care. So get on with it!"
Davood heaved a sigh. He and Anila had been watched since the moment they'd arrived. What was there to do but suffer it until the kings came to trust him?
"Anila,"
he said softly. The ends of the heavy curtains flapped and scuffed over the floor.
"It's time to change your bandages."
She didn't stir, nor did she make a move to stop him as he pulled her up to a sitting position. She remained still while Davood, shielding her as best he could from Xander's view, began to unwrap the bandages. Around her head he went, revealing a bald scalp. Her skin, once a healthy copper hue, was darkened, not like the Asirim's skin, which was a deep, deep brown, but more a mottled grey. And where once her skin had been smooth and supple, it was now uneven, dry as a sun-cracked riverbed, and nearly as hard. In the weeks after the devastating events in Ishmantep, where they'd chased the blood mage, Hamzakir, Davood had hoped her skin would return to normal. Every night he had prayed to Yurinde to return some of Anila's beauty to her, or sometimes to Rhea, that she might be made anew, as the goddess was each new moon. In one of his low moments, he'd even prayed to Baki to take her life that she might be granted a new one in the farther fields. He'd convinced himself that if Anila could speak, she would ask to be done with this remnant of a life. Why else had she been silent since the fire that Davood had managed to snuff, using blood magic at the terrible cost of Anila's body? Over the days that followed, he had been shamed by the very thought that he'd considered making this choice for her, and worse, that he had wondered if he ought to take matters into his own hands. He continued to unwrap the bandage, tugging it when necessary, wincing at the pain it might cause. He did her arms next, and then, after lifting her arms up, a position she held without comment, unwrapped the one around her chest. As always, he felt supremely conscious of her privacy, of the embarrassment she might be feeling, even if it was masked in silence. The matrons had asked him if he would rather they do this for him, but he had only accepted their help for the first few times so he could learn how to properly tend to her needs. He'd done it every time since. This was his burden. He had done this to her, and he would help her as much as he was able, at least until she was well enough to return to her family's estate in Golden Hill. The bandages removed, he proceeded to rough her skin with a brush made from the ridge hair of a bone crusher. Anila's eyes reddened, her breath quickened, and tears began to stream down her cheeks. Davu continued to work methodically. The faster he moved, the sooner her pain would end. But he did whisper, "I'm sorry," softly enough that Xander wouldn't hear. He knew he said it too often, knew that if Anila could speak she'd most likely scream for him to stop saying it, but the words came practically unbidden. Silent, Anila kept her gaze focused squarely on the rough stone wall. He brushed all of her exposed skin, even around her face and ears, moving on from each section only after her skin had taken on a rougher, flakier appearance. When he was done, he set the brush down and began peeling. Like dried, sunburnt skin, swathes of it came off at once to reveal dark, shining indigo skin. Snake skin. Davud remembered thinking the first time it had happened. The gods have given her snake skin. He buried the thoughts and continued, trying to minimize Anila's discomfort and exposure. Her tears continued, twin rivulets glistening on the black skin of her cheeks. She became cold as the old skin came off every few weeks. Indeed, she was starting to shiver already. But he didn't skimp on the final step, which was to clean her with a wet cloth. When he was done, her skin gleamed, like a black mamba, like one of Gojin's children. Not for the first time, Davud wished he could speak to Master Amelos about all this. He'd been devastated to learn of his old master's death, murdered in the tunnels below the city, he'd been told. He missed the man's calm intellect, his ability to reason through problems rather than become frustrated by them. It was something Davud could use more of. His guilt over Anila's injuries was constantly clouding his judgment. Taking up the glass jar, he rubbed salve over her arms, chest, and back, and finished by wrapping her in fresh bandages. After laying her back down, he repeated the entire process on her legs and pelvis.
"They say you'll be done soon enough," Davud said softly as he spread the salve. "That you'll have healed. You can return to your family, or, if you wish, remain here with me. The steward said it would be allowed as long as I'm a guest of the king's."
Just how long that would be, his remaining here as a guest, Davud had no idea. The kings knew he was a blood mage, knew that he'd been given some small amount of training by Hamzakir. Surely they'd suspect Davud was one of his agents. They might still suspect that, despite all Davud had said to convince them otherwise.
"The fates will decide," Davud told himself, while finishing with her calves and feet. "I'll spend no more nights wondering if the kings have decided to murder me."
In truth, he'd spent little time wondering what the future held. He wanted to make sure Anila was well cared for. There was time enough to worry about his own needs after that, and when she was healed, she would want to return to Golden Hill, not to remain in the House of Kings. But in all honesty, he couldn't say what her family would want. He had been present the first time her mother and sister had visited. Her mother had been horrified by her daughter's reptilian skin. She'd taken Davud away to speak with him, grateful he had been there to tell her what had befallen her daughter.
"Has she been cursed?"
she had asked bluntly near the end of their conversation. What could Davud say?
"Of course she's been cursed, and all because of me. I couldn't say," he remembered replying. Better to speak to a priest than me. Which, though?
It was an echo of his own fears that cruel Gojan had touched her.
Best to begin at Baki's,
he had replied. She had visited twice more. Both times, whatever small glimmer of hope she had in her eyes had been snuffed not only by Neela's state, but her daughter's cold indifference to her, to Davood, to the world around her. She hadn't returned. Anila's sister hadn't deigned to come again, and her father had never come. Perhaps finding himself unable to stand before his daughter after the strange reports brought to him by his wife. Part of Davood wanted him to visit, so he could call the man a bloody coward to his face. But another part wanted him there for Anila. A knock came at the door. Xander opened it, and in swept a woman in white robes. After giving Davood a perfunctory nod, the matron, a terse, middle-aged woman named Kaylira, took in the state of the room. She looked, as always, as if she were the palace steward and had personally assigned Davood to ensure the place was immaculate.
King Sukru is on the way.
She said it so abruptly and with so little warmth that it took Davood a moment to understand.
King Sukru, but why would he?
She moved to the bedside and inspected Anila's bandages carefully. She might have been pleased. Had she not been, Davood would have heard about it. But you wouldn't know it from the sour look on her face.
It isn't yours to question the king's. Though I deem it probable he wishes to speak of your time with the traitor Hamzikir.
Moving to the same shelf where Davood had taken up the salve, she retrieved a bottle filled with lilac-coloured liquid, which she poured into a teapot with a long, thin spout. Taking the teapot, she returned to Anila's bed and trickled the distillation over the bandages. To hasten the formation of new, healthy skin, she'd told Davood weeks ago, though what help it might be providing, he had no idea. No matter what they did, debriding it with brushes, applying the salve to her skin, and a half dozen different distillations to her bandages over the course of her weeks here, her skin retained its midnight hue, its strange, snakeskin feel.
When will he?
Presently,
said a hoary voice from the door. Davood turned and saw a crooked man dressed in curled leather slippers and a simple black khalat. Simple for a king, that is. Both Kaylira and Davood bowed, but King Sukru waved the formalities away. Behind him, a girl with pigtails stuck her head in the room.
Leave us, Kaylira. And Xandrithus, you as well. And take Bella with you. Of course, Excellence.
And they left, Xander guiding the girl by the shoulder, and Kaylira closing the door behind her.
Infernal girl,
Sukru said under his breath. As she shuffled closer to the bed, his eyes turned on Anila.
Well, well. The burned one I've heard so much about.
She wasn't burned, Davood said. She was...
I know,
Sukru said, his small eyes narrowing.
Drawn thin like thread from wool in your attempt at quelling the flames in Ishmantep.
Drawn thin like thread from wool. He'd never heard it described as such, but there was some truth to it. Her body had suffered the effects, but it was Davood's drawing on her soul that had caused it. As Sukru reached the bedside, Anila gave no sign she noticed them. She stared at the ceiling, blinking every so often. The king picked up one hand, examined her fingernails carefully.
She eats.
Yes, Davood replied, feeling awkward standing so close to a king.
Does she soil herself?
Setting her hand down, Sukru drew a short knife from inside his left sleeve, the sort cooks use to pare apples and the like, then tugged back the bandages covering Anila's shoulder.
No, she uses the pot we bring for her.
Sukru lifted his head and scowled at Davood.
But she does not speak.
He returned to his examination of her shoulder. After bringing his eyes close and squinting, he brought the blade close and scraped it along Anila's scaly skin. He did so lightly at first, then in stronger, longer waves. Anila's eyes pinched, then they began to redden. She winced with every stroke of the blade.
Please, my lord, Davood said. There's no need for that.
He turned his beady eyes on Davood.
I asked you a question.
No, she hasn't spoken since the incident.
Incident?
A low rumble of a laugh escaped Sukru.
Tell me about it, boy, this incident.
Davood told Sukru everything. The voyage to Ishmantep after escaping the moonless host, the fire along Ishmantep's docks, how Anila had offered her blood and Davood had accepted. King Sukru watched most intently when Davood spoke of using the power of Anila's blood, how he had caught the flame and smothered it, and how in doing so he had burned Anila through their bond. He had recounted this tale a dozen times since returning to Sharakai. He'd even told it in this very room, but he'd never done so in front of Anila. It made the story feel weighty in a way it never had before, as if he now stood before a tribunal, and the king was preparing to render judgment for his crimes. He supposed, looking at this immortal man who stood proxy for the other kings, it wasn't too far from the truth.
I didn't know this would happen,
he said at last, glancing uncomfortably toward Anila.
I'd been swept away by the fire, but the sheer power in her blood. Yes, yes,
Sukru waved his hand, brushing Davood's words away like a platter of honeyed sweets.
When did she last speak? Ishmantep.
Did we finish it?
She had asked as they stood beside the still-smoking ship. She had meant the men within the Royal Clipper. Had she and Davood saved them?
We did, he had whispered to her. We saved them all. That's good, she replied, her words soft as gossamer. That's good.
The king was staring at Anila uncharitably, the way one might at a thoroughbred that had developed a limp. He was weighing a decision he wouldn't give a second thought to once it was made. He wasn't called the Reaping King for no reason. Davood was trying to formulate the right words to divert the king's thoughts from Anila and her fate when Sukru reached into the folds of his robes and drew out a small book. The very one Hamzakir had penned for Davood.
Hamzakir gave you this?
He did.
Sukru thumbed through it, as if it were nothing more than a curiosity.
You are a learned young man.
Davood stammered his reply.
You honor me, my king.
Closing the book with a snap, Sukru frowned, his uneven gaze boring deeply.
Do you wish to join the service of the kings, to help us balance the scales of justice?
I don't understand, Your Excellence.
Sukru's small eyes sharpened, giving him a rat-like look.
Will you serve me as we hunt for Hamzikir and drive the scarabs from the desert?
I only thought...
He motioned to the book in Sukru's hands.
I thought the use of blood magic was forbidden.
The kings decide what is forbidden.
Of course, Your Excellence.
At this, he withdrew a vial from his right sleeve. The vial was made of translucent green glass, tipped with a silver cap, to which was affixed a needle. Within the vial was a dark liquid that sloshed as he flicked his fingers to Davoud's left arm.
My king?
I require assurances from those who enter into my service.
He flicked his fingers again.
Given your nature, I'm sure you understand.
He wanted Davoud's blood. He suddenly wished he were anywhere but here. But what was there to do now? He held out his arm, and Sukru grabbed his wrist and pierced his skin near the elbow. He collected the blood, then swirled it around, stoppered it, and slipped it back inside his sleeve. To Davoud's surprise and growing horror, he withdrew another vial and repeated the ritual with Anila. When he was done, her red blood spread from the wound, stark against the white bandages over her indigo skin.
But she's no mage,
Davoud said, powerless to stop him.
But she is,
he said while swirling Anila's blood.
A rather unique specimen.
Davoud didn't like that word, specimen, nor the way he'd said it. Away the vial went into Sukru's sleeve with the other.
5 nights hence, you will accompany me to the blooming fields.
The king waited with a curious look on his face. He looked rather like one of the masters in the collegia after they had posed a particularly tricky riddle to his students. The answer came to Davoud a moment later.
Bet Shahir is 5 nights hence.
Sukru's flat expression made it clear he'd expected more.
God, Davoud had never been close to the blooming fields. Their legend was fearful enough, but it was the Asirim themselves that made Davoud's knees quake. If you'll forgive my presumption, my lord king, what are we to do there?
Some of the Adhikara have been withering and are close to death. You'll investigate.
Sukru tossed the book to Davoud, who caught it, confused.
You'll find more sigils in those pages, he said. Master them before we depart.
Gods, he means blood magic. I cannot, my king.
Ah, but you can.
He strode for the door.
Your king demands it.
He left, letting the door swing open behind him. When his footsteps had faded, Davoud thumbed through the book, horrified at what Sukru was asking him to do. This was what had led to Anila's disfigurement. He had forsworn the practice entirely, except for that which kept him from pain as the change within him continued to settle. He soon found the pages to which Sukru had referred. Written in a scratchy hand, so different from Hamza Kia's tall, elegant penmanship, were 2 additional sigils, one for flora and another for poison or decay. The text below wasn't quite clear. Suddenly, the hungry look on Sukru's face when he had questioned Davoud about his use of blood magic made sense. It had been jealousy, not simple curiosity. That, coupled with the fact that he had asked Davoud to join him, implied 2 important things. First, that there was some puzzle Sukru desperately wanted to solve, and second, that he wasn't gifted enough to do it alone. Davoud felt sick. He hadn't wanted the curse of magic when Hamza Kier told him of it, and he didn't want it now. He'd give it up in the beat of a butterfly's wings if he could. But he couldn't. It was foolish to pretend otherwise. Turning the pages, he found an overlaid sigil, penned in 3 different inks. It combined the 2 earlier sigils with a 3rd, the one for binding, or mastery that appeared earlier in the book. What the king meant him to do with it, he wasn't certain. He turned back toward Anila and shivered. She was no longer staring at the ceiling. She still